change around my team. Yeah, we off the leash. You could look us in the eyes and see we have peace. Black and gold, that's the colors when we go to war. When we step up on that field, you gon' hear my roar. We them tiger cats, we them tiger cats. We them tiger cats, we them tiger cats.
Yeah, nobody hitting harder. Better keep your guard up. Cause with everything we draw, we can score it when we wanna.
Welcome to Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Michael Graham.
Mike, it is, can you believe this? This stunned me when I realized it. We are going into our fifth season of the show. Can you believe that? Five seasons of us dissecting Ticats football on a mostly weekly basis?
It's crazy to me. Time flies, especially as you get older. We started this podcast seems like 2 or 3 years ago, but 5 years and still going strong. Hopefully add another 5 years to that and then keep going from there.
And all the ups and downs. We started it on the heels of the Ticats losing that heartbreaking Grey Cup to the Calgary Stampeders. Our first episode was talking about the flag for blocking the back. Here we are 4 years and five seasons later. We're getting ready to gear up for our fifth season covering this team, and I'm not sure if they're any closer to a Grey Cup championship than they were when we started, but it's been a pretty interesting first four seasons covering the team, and here's hoping season five is just as interesting, but hopefully a little bit more fun.
Yeah, and maybe a championship at the end of the season. That would be nice to talk about.
Maybe. We almost had one that first year we did the show, dude.
So close.
I feel like we're a jinx, but you never know. It's just fun talking football with you. It's great to be back. 2019, we're back at it, ready to get going. So let's jump right into the news. The Ticats news, of course, first. We're going to start with the thing. The reason what was it, 2 weeks ago now we had planned on doing this show? And then we just kept going.
I tweeted out something. Going to do a show next week, and then 2 weeks later, here we are. But yeah. My apologies for that.
Yes, but it has nothing to do with us. We were ready. We're getting ready to do it. We just needed the Ticats to actually make a goddamn announcement. We had rumors and Justin Dunk said this was going to happen, so we trusted him, but it would be easier once it was official to sit down and talk about it. And of course, we're talking about the Ticats unveiling their coaching staff for 2019. We knew some of the principals involved. We knew Orlando Steinhauer was going to be the head coach. We knew Drew Jones was going to be the offensive coordinator. And then everything else was kind of rumored innuendo until it was, official, even though our boy JD had it. Mark Washington is going to be this team's defensive coordinator. Jeff Reinbold is coming back home to be the special teams coordinator, which I know, not to editorialize yet because we're going to get in a second, that makes a lot of people happy. Tommy Condell, the former offensive coordinator, is back as a wide receivers coach. Dennis McKnight will be running the offensive line once again. And then we have some newcomers here. Robin Ross will be the linebackers coach. Randy Melvin will be the defensive line coach. And then a couple of holdovers from last season. Craig Butler becomes a defensive backs coach and a special teams assistant. And Jared Baines becomes the assistant wide receivers coach and the offensive quality control coach. So I guess the big ones are the two coordinating jobs, Washington and Reinbold. What do you think about those moves? You got to love that Jeff Reinbold's back in black and gold, don't you?
I do. When Reinbold was with this team as a special teams coordinator, for the most part, we were at the top of the league in most categories, touchdowns, block punts, all that good stuff. It kind of fell off near the end of his tenure as a special teams coordinator. And then we know what happened with when he became the DC. That didn't go well at all. But I'm very happy to have him back. Hopefully he can, get some of that magic back that he had in his first couple seasons with the Ticats.
Yeah, the special teams has kind of been the weak link for this team the last couple of years since he stopped being special teams coordinator. As you said, went to the defensive coordinator role in 2017. That was a bit of a disaster. He was fired midway through the season. And, of course, last year it was Frank Gantz Jr. who ran our special teams. Never really had any experience in the CFL before. I think you could kind of tell there was There was less sort of Reinbold, you know, he did the tricks. He did the onside punts. He did stuff like that that guys who are familiar with this league will pull off. The return game was a bit not great, I think would be a kind way of putting it. Oh my God, I'm drawing a blank here on what we call them. The coverage teams. There we go. The coverage teams were decent but not spectacular. I think with Reinbold back in the fold, I think we're going to see some really good special teams play out of the Ticats, which I think will help both the offense and the defense. One of the talking points last year, Mike, I'm sure you remember, was how the offense kept starting so deep in their own field or their, on their own side of the field. If we can get 5, 10, 15 extra yards on these returns, that sets up the offense, which I think is going to be even more potent now that June Jones is not the head coach slash offensive coordinator. It's just the offensive coordinator. I'm really excited to see what he can do when he's just playing with those toolbox. Like, he's just got those toys playing with them in the sandbox. You know what I mean? Like, he's not worried about what's happening with the team. He can just focus on the offense. I think it's going to be one of the most explosive offenses in the CFL. And you add in the experience of Jeff Reinbold, we get some better yardage on those returns, sets the offensive up better. I think it's going to be really, really fantastic. What do you think about Mark Washington? What do you think about bringing him in? And also, you know, Reinbold's in BC last year. That's, he was with Washington there. What do you kind of think of him being the DC?
I'm not overwhelmed with it. I've seen a lot of stuff online, a lot of Ticat fans like being really excited for about this move. But I'm going to hold back my you know, excitement, because I'm looking at his stats here. And, you know, as a DC with the BC Lions in 2014, that was his first year. He was third with 365 points against, 20.28 per game. Well, that's pretty good. 2015, it drops a bit to sixth overall in the league, 486 points, 27 a game. 2016, fourth in the league, you know, middle of the pack, 454 points a game, 25.22 per game. And in 2017, drops to seventh overall in the league for points against, 27.83 points a game per game. And then last year, he was also seventh with 473 points against per game. So to me, I mean, Mark Washington is a middle-of-the-pack defensive coordinator. He's not a top-end guy like a
Did you commit? Are you getting arrested?
I might be. I might have to find a new replacement here. But he's the middle-of-the-road defensive coordinator. You know, judging by his numbers, he's not a Noel Thorpe. He's not a Devon Claybrooks. He's not a Chris Jones. But he's okay. So I'm not overly excited about the move.
I can't remember who said it, and I wish I would have written it down, but it was a while ago when Mark Washington's name was floated out there as a possible defensive coordinator for the Ticats. Someone said, when he's the name you're least excited about on the coaching staff, that's pretty good coaching staff. And I think Mark Washington is a decent defensive coordinator. I do wonder, you mentioned those numbers, and the things that pop into my head are, last year he lost his best defensive player in Solomon Elamimian for the majority of the season. The year before, they lost Adam Big Hill to the NFL with the New Orleans Saints. So I see, if you lose talent like that, it's hard to maintain a level of excellence. You're right. He's not in, you know, the upper echelon with those defenses. But I do wonder, depending on the talent that could come back, I think that's obviously, you know, free agency is coming up in about a month. Who's going to be on this team is obviously going to play a major role in how successful these coaches are in some respects. But I think of, if he can get and kind of shape the defense into what he wants, I think we've seen some near elite level defensive play. You mentioned third in points allowed, fourth in points allowed. Yeah, it's kind of middle of the pack, but third's top third of the league. Like, if this team can...
And seventh 2 years in a row.
Yeah, but like I said, no Solomon Elamimi, and that's going to hurt your defense, and no Adam Big Hill. That's going to... You lose those guys like that to injury or to attrition, that's going to hurt. That's going to take a little bit getting used to, because you're bringing in guys that maybe aren't as skilled, maybe aren't as comfortable. You never know. Now, could that be a sign of that he's taking a step back? Maybe. But could it change his scenery? Also sort of give him that extra boost of, okay, I can do something else here. He's not coaching under Wally Buono anymore. Maybe that'll be a little bit there. Like, I feel this seems like, at least from everything we've heard from Orlando Steinhauer, this is going to be much more of a collaborative effort. And I'm not saying that working for Wally Buono wasn't collaborative, but Buono's an old school coach. He's the head coach. He does things his way. This is a little bit different. Washington and Steinhauer are about the same age. Like, I'm cautiously optimistic, but I do understand where you're coming from. But I feel like you don't last that long as a defensive coordinator just by luck. He obviously did the job fairly well and had the trust of the coaches he worked with in BC. There's a reason he was brought over here. I think this could be pretty good. And we've got to remember, as great as Jerry Glanville was last year, that defense tailed off at the end of the season. I'd much rather have sort of like they were excellent in the first like two-thirds of the season and then like took a nosedive in the last like month and a half. So give me a defense that's like kind of solid, maybe even unspectacular throughout. I think I'd rather have that so you know what you're getting each week than this sort of like up and down play that we saw from the Ticats defense last year.
That's fair. And on the bright side here, Josh, I averaged out his 5 years as defensive coordinator, and his points against average over 5 years was 25.322. Now, Jones's offense last year averaged 28.5 points. So do the math, we're going to be 18-0, I think.
Fair, fair, fair. What do you think about the news that Tommy Condell's coming back? That's in a much lesser capacity than he was here last time. But here's what I'm going to say. I think this is Tommy, come back here, be the wide receivers coach. June Jones only has a year or two left. He gets bumped up to the OC job. That's what I think is going on here.
Yeah, I always thought that Tommy should have had a OC job somewhere. And you might be right about that. I'm assuming you will be right about that. But it's great to have him back. It's like, oh, the angry dad has left the house. And now all the kids are coming back. Jeff Reinbold's back. And Tommy Condell's back now that Austin's gone. Now it's
I'm not disagreeing with you on that. I honestly think the band gets back together because kind of the stern taskmaster is no longer here.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Austin's gone. So now all the people are coming back. You know, Condell's back. Reinbold's back. Ken Austin isn't around anymore. And
Steinhauer came back last year.
Steinhauer. Yeah. So everybody's coming back. And I think Tommy Condell is a great addition. You know, he's the receivers coach. But, you know, there's a lot of knowledge there. There's a lot of things that he's going to bring to the table for that offense. So I'm thrilled to have him back.
So speaking of Ken Austin, you kind of touched on it. He became a consultant for the team last year, and now he is no longer under the employ of the Hamilton Tiger Cats. He is now the offensive coordinator and quarterback coach for Liberty University under former Ole Miss head coach Hugh Freeze. I believe I said last year, maybe at this time, maybe a little later, that if Ken Austin was still a part of the Ticats organization in a year's time, I'd be shocked. I'm a little surprised that he would take such a small role. I felt that he could have been one of the candidates for a head coaching position this offseason in the CFL, but you look at the situation where he's going to want to be the head man on the field and off, so maybe he takes this one stop here at Liberty for a year. Maybe he heads to Montreal next year when they completely got that team and he takes over there. That's just speculation on my part. I feel like he's too good a coach to just be an offensive coordinator and a quarterback coach at a university that I didn't even know existed prior to him being named their offensive coordinator. But that's it. Austin is out of Hamilton. He's no longer a member of the organization. All told, he spent, five seasons, four-ish seasons as the head coach. They made the playoffs his first 4 years. As head coach, they went to 2 Grey Cups, 3 East Finals. Every time we talk about it, the magical 2015 season, that wasn't, unfortunately. They bounced back last year with him in a consultant role, although what he did, I don't know. What do you think, ultimately, Ken Austin's legacy with the Ticats will be? Because there were some tremendous highs, and then, of course, there was the 0-8 start two years ago that ended his tenure as coach. Overall, when you think of the Austin era of the Hamilton Tiger Cats, Mike, what would you think of?
Well, overall, I think the fandom will think of the 0-8 because that's the latest, you know, thing that happened with his coaching tenure in Hamilton. But overall, I mean, he had a 48-50 regular season record, it's not great, but two Grey Cup appearances. To really bring this team back to relevancy, they were okay before him. You know, floated around 9-9, and they had 2-10-8 records, which is, you know, winning records, which doesn't happen very often with the Tie Cats.
Very rare.
So very, very rare. And he was this close to winning us a Grey Cup. So to me, I'm going to remember Ken Austin very fondly as the Tie Cats head coach.
Yeah, me too. He brought pride, I think, back to being a Tie Cats fan. Like, the Belfay era, which wasn't very long, was kind of – it got the ball rolling, and it's like, now we're a playoff team all of a sudden. And, okay, now every year we expect this team to make the playoffs. They take the step back with Cortez. They bring in Austin, and bam, first year with all that adversity in Guelph, 10-8, Grey Cup trip, beating the Argos in the East Final. That will be the lasting memory for me. That and beating the Alouettes in the East Final, the first East Final played in Hamilton since 1998. Those two games, being at those live in person, I will always remember. Beating the Argos in Toronto to seal a trip to the Grey Cup for the first time in almost 15 years is one of those games that I can't believe it was almost 6 years ago. It feels like yesterday that it just happened. But yeah, I'm with you, man. I will look back on it. Yeah, the 0-8, the terseness with both the media and just like his general attitude, especially near the end there. The unfortunate injury to Zach Caleros that had nothing to do with him, but that probably scuttled him basically getting a statue built of him in front of Tim Hortons Field and I'll say it till I'm blue in the face, and I don't care who disagrees with me, that team was on fire. I don't think they would have lost another game the rest of the season, and I think they would have rolled to a Grey Cup victory in 2015 if Caleros doesn't get hurt. I think that completely changed not only the trajectory of this franchise and of Caleros' career, but of Austin's tenure here as well. Because they win that Grey Cup, even if they start 0-8 2 years later, he doesn't get fired. You will ride that out because it's like 2 years ago they won the Grey Cup, so it's not that big a deal. It changed everything. But ultimately, I will look back and go, two Grey Cup appearances, three East Final appearances, and just genuinely good football. Like, the Tie Cats, win or lose, for the most part, are at least a fun team to watch, and sports at its most elemental is entertainment. And I would rather go be entertained and watch a fun game than sit through a slog. Like, that those terrible teams that we had for all those years in the mid-2000s, they were just so boring to watch, win or lose.
So bad. So bad.
At least these teams were entertaining. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
They were going to score touchdowns. They were going to be in tight games. They might win some blowouts. They might get blown out. But there was always – it didn't feel like a chore to have to sit down and watch a Tie Cats game. So, yeah, I will remember Ken Austin's tenure fondly. I guess it'll be remembered kind of as failed expectations. I think the expectation was that he would come in here and get this team to a Grey Cup and win it finally. And that didn't happen. So, ultimately, they didn't succeed. But – no, for the most part, I think Austin's legacy with the team it's a pretty good one. Let's talk, kind of speaking of Austin, speaking of coaches, the Tie Cats also unveiled a football operations staff. And there's some kind of takeaways here. The big one, I think, is Eric Tillman is out as general manager, and it looks like he's going to be heading out to the East Coast to head up the football ops staff for the Atlantic Schooners. The team did not name a general manager. They ended up going with what looks like a committee approach with Sean Burke and Drew Alamang, who have both been named senior director of personnel and co-manager of football operations. Jim Barker was hired as a consultant. Spencer Zimmerman was brought back from the Argos to the Tie Cats to be the team's director of U.S. scouting. Zimmerman, I think most people will know his name from when he basically ran free agency for the Argos in 2017 when Barker was fired and before they had hired Jim Popp. So he kind of pieced together that 2017 Argos team that went and won a freaking Grey Cup. So kind of a lot happening here. Let's start with Burke and Alamang. What do you think of this co-manager setup?
It's interesting. I'll say that if it was any two other guys, I'd probably have a problem with it, but these guys have been working together for a long time and have done a great job with the with the Canadian scouting that I know of, they've helped out a lot, and they've got some great Canadian talent in here, and we all know that that's a huge part of the CFL. So them doing the job, co-general managers, I don't have a problem with, because I have so much faith in those two guys.
I think it's one of those things, I'm with you. If you don't know how this team is operated, and it's operated kind of on a committee approach even before this, with Burke and Alamang and Tillman and Austin to a certain extent, and then June Jones last year, and now I'm guaranteeing you Steinhauer's involved. It's kind of been like a collaborative effort anyway, and I think you have these guys. Burke has risen through the ranks of this team. I believe he started with them in like 06 or 07 as like a community relations like PR guy, and he's risen into the role of essentially general manager. Alamang has been the team's sort of Canadian draft guru, and I'm not sure, and again, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure some people will point it out. I'm not sure you can point to a team that's had a better run of draft picks than the Hamilton Tigercats have the last few years. Some of their picks, whether they're late round picks or they're early round picks that are kind of maybe not seen as the norm. Like I just think of the Brandon Revenberg pick, not on the CFL's top 20 of the scouting bureau. The Ticats traded up to pick him, and everyone's kind of like, what? Look at him now. He was a finalist for the league's most outstanding offensive lineman award. I think of a guy like Sean Thomas Erlington, who we'll talk about in a little bit. An eighth round pick, Mike. You can go to Wikipedia and look at recent CFL drafts. Go back the last 5-10 years and look at the names of guys who went in the sixth, seventh, eighth rounds. There's going to be names of guys that you don't remember. And this guy is now, he re-signed. We'll talk about that in a bit. Has become a contributor for this team as an eighth round pick. Alamang knows the Canadian draft. Burke has a lot of experience with contract negotiations, stuff like that. I think from an outsider's perspective, this looks really awkward and could lead to trouble. I think with the two guys involved and their history together, I don't think this is going to be a problem whatsoever.
No, I don't think so either. I think they'll do a tremendous job. You know, they have a lot of experience. Jim Barker is going to be there. I know that. You know, he's done some questionable moves as GM in the past, but he's just another guy, another set of eyes that can help out in the equation.
Well, can we get him on our sideline now telling the referees that a guy is a fingernail offside to get another play? Because that would be pretty helpful.
Yeah, I would not mind that. I did mind it when he's with the Argos, but, you know, any advantage we can get, Josh.
We need him. We need all we can get. What do you think about Eric Tillman being out, and what do you think about him heading to Halifax to head up the Schooners? I'm going to say this, Mike. I know you, much like Drew Edwards, has been very skeptical about this whole thing coming about. Guys, you don't start paying a guy to be the football ops head if you don't think you're going to have a football ops to head up. That's all I'm going to say.
That's true. That's a good point. You know, Tillman's time in Hamilton has been an interesting one. He kind of lived in the shadows there for a couple years until he was officially named the GM. But we pretty much knew that he had that role, you know, before the official announcement. I'm not too upset about him leaving. I don't think it's necessarily the right hire for a brand new franchise. And we've talked about, you know, the trouble he's been in the past. And I've said before that, you know, people deserve second chances, and he hasn't done anything wrong since that incident in Saskatchewan. But I just think you're starting a new franchise. I think it's the wrong foot to start off on, hiring a guy that has, you know, criminal charges. And I don't think he was officially charged, but he was in court and all that stuff for the incident. So I just think it's kind of a bad PR move on the Atlantic Schooners' part.
Well, the two things that are going to follow around Eric Tillman for probably the rest of his life are the charges you're talking about and the Ricky Ray trade. Those are going to be the two black marks on him. One is a football thing, and you know what? Guys make trades all the time. And if you really wanted to dig into this, I could tell you why trading Ricky Ray actually worked out better for Edmonton. Because in trading Ricky Ray, they set themselves up to go get Mike Riley. If they still have Ricky Ray in-house, Mike Riley's playing somewhere else, maybe even playing in Toronto. And I would not have liked that very much, Mike. I prefer Mike Riley in Edmonton or potentially, depending on what happens this offseason, playing in BC. I don't want him in my division. I don't want to have to deal with that guy on a 2, 3, 4 times a year. No, thank you. The other stuff, the off-the-field stuff, that's there's nothing you do about it now. That's disgusting what he did. Everyone who knows who Eric Tillman is knows what that is. We don't have to get into that here. I think maybe he gets brought in because he's an experienced hand, and he even has experience with an expansion franchise. He was the GM for the Renegades when they came into the league in, what, 01, 02, whenever that was. Now, they weren't very good, and I think he was only there 2 years, and that team never made the playoffs in its existence. But at the same time, the expansion draft rules were different, and they weren't as conducive to getting a team up and playing at a high level early on. Maybe that's different this time. But I, like I said at the top, the big thing that I take from this is you don't bring in a guy and put him on your payroll if you don't think you're going to have a football team to run. So I think I just look at this in sort of like the macro sense and go, this is a good step towards us finally getting team number 10.
It definitely is a good sign that they're hiring people. I mean, it'd be great to see them up and running in 2020 in Moncton or something like that, but we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
What we won't have to wait and see, Mike, is the Ticats actually getting a couple of free agents or pending free agents signed a contract. You mentioned him earlier. Sean Thomas Erlington signed a 2-year deal to remain with the Ticats, which I think is a pretty cool deal. I'm glad he's coming back. That's a special teams guy, a versatile player who can play receiver and running back. And as I said, helps on specials. I think that's a good guy to get. Canadian guy as well, obviously. Kelvin Palmer, who played a little at the left tackle position to end the season last year, kind of swapped out with Avery Jordan after Tony Washington was traded. And I think Jordan missed a game for personal reasons. Palmer came in. I think he played pretty well. I think the offensive line in general played pretty well. Another thing, we're losing my boy, Riker Matthews, to, of all teams, the bloody New England Patriots. So I can't even be happy that he's going to the NFL. But I do wish him the best of luck there, as I'm sure you do as well. But there's going to be a hole at the right side there. I wonder what's going to happen there. But the big news, this happened so long ago, it almost barely warrants mentioning from you and I, but it's still a huge thing. Jalen Saunders signed a 1-year deal to come back to the Ticats. That is, I wrote a piece about it for 3Down. And I talked about how underrated Jalen Saunders actually is. And if you look at his numbers before he went down to injury, they were neck and neck with Brandon Banks. The only thing that really separated the two were touchdowns. But catches and yards, they were neck and neck. This guy is a stud, and I think people around the league are going to finally see that when he gets a chance to get fully healthy. I imagine he's probably not going to be ready to start the season. But, you know, getting injured around, I think it was at Labor Day, if I'm not mistaken, that he got hurt. So I imagine around Labor Day is when he's going to come back. But him and now June Jones, the offensive coordinator, only like him in this offense has been a stud. I think we're going to see him be a stud again once he gets back healthy. Mike, how happy were you when you saw the news that Saunders was coming back?
Pretty damn happy. You don't expect to see big names like that signed before the CBA is agreed upon, but I'm glad to have him back. A funny fact, he was actually found in the Spring League in 2017. He played in 16 games in his rookie year, replacing injured Terrence Tolliver, gained 1,170 yards and 4 touchdowns. And then you mentioned the 2018 numbers. He had 739 yards and 2 touchdowns in 9 games. This guy, if he ever is able to put a full season together, he will be an all-star player. That's for sure, especially in this run-and-shoot style offense that June Jones runs. He's just perfect for it. Him and Brandon Banks are perfect for that offense. And imagine if they can both, you know, if Saunders comes back halfway through or something like that, and Banks can stay healthy the whole season, these guys are going to put up monster numbers, I think.
That 1,170 you mentioned from Saunders, that led the Ticats in receiving it. You know, it was like 4th in the league. And people never bring that up. Like, I think he was behind Zylstra, Greg Ellingson, and like Brian Burnham. And then it was Jalen Saunders, who was a rookie and like never got any consideration for rookie of the year because, you know, James Wilder Jr. was so great for the Argos. But like, I'm telling you, man,
what happened last year with him? I don't know.
Well,
he fell off, didn't he?
Go look at his rookie numbers. Saunders' numbers were better there too. You know what I mean? Like, this guy is a beast. Like, he's one of those guys that if you're not a Ticats fan, I don't think you realize just how good and how important he is. But I think him coming back, I think let him get healthy. I think him signing is, hey, man, you know, you're guaranteed to come back next year. You just got to get healthy. I think this is a great thing. I think he's going to put up some big numbers. I think this is just the start of him. He's only signed a 1-year deal from what I understand. I think this could be just, hey, okay, because if he comes back and he's not the player he was, then, you know, the team moves on. It sucks, but that's what happens. If he comes back and puts up numbers, he's bet on himself. He's just going to get a bigger contract the year after, or maybe even get another shot in the NFL. Who knows? But I'm just very happy that he's returning because I'm looking forward to seeing him in this offense once again. And he's probably not going to put up monster numbers if he only plays, you know, 8, 9, 10 games. But I'd rather have those 8, 9, 10 games come at the end of the season, Mike, than at the beginning.
Yeah, it could be, you know, 8, 9 games for him could be 900 or 1,000 yards. You never know. So as long as we can get him in next year at some point, I'll be happy.
Let's talk some CFL news. And obviously, I think everyone knows where we're going to start here. It was the bombshell announcement that Chris Jones was leaving the Saskatchewan Roughriders to take a job with the Cleveland Browns as, and this is his exact job title, Senior Defensive Specialist. Now, I don't want to talk too much about Jones leaving because our buddies Joel and John on the Three Down Nation Greencast have already talked about this at length. So go hit up their episode that they just released this week where they talk about Chris Jones leaving. But this was a stunning, shocking, flooring, like you name it. This came out of nowhere and was just, okay, what's next? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was pretty surprising, especially the role that he took. I mean, he's not the DC. He's an extra set of eyes, essentially, for the defense. From going from, you know, he does everything in Saskatchewan, head coach, defensive coordinator, GM, vice president, to a very small, you know, role with the Cleveland Browns. Now, maybe I think he has connections with the head coach. That's why he got hired. And maybe there's an opportunity there in future years to step up and become, you know, a defensive coordinator or something like that. But to go from such a big role with the Riders to such a tiny role with the Browns is pretty interesting.
I think it's a foot in the door. I think this was always the goal for him. I believe our buddy Joel mentioned it on the Greencast this week or last week on their episode that this is always how Jones leaving the Riders was going to happen. He wasn't going to get fired. He wasn't going to move on to another CFL team. He was going to leave for an NFL coaching job. I believe Joel said he thought it would happen next year. So he's not surprised this happened, but this was just because it came out of nowhere. It came a week after it was announced that he had signed an extension into 2020. So you're like, okay, he's going to be around one more year. You kind of get that extension so he's not a lame duck coach, all that other sorts of stuff. It was just kind of, you know, I'm sitting around just, you know, scrolling social media and then boom, Chris Jones is leaving the Riders and it kind of throws them into complete disarray. And then we had what happened over the weekend, which is what I would like to talk about a little bit. I guess it wouldn't be an episode of our show if I didn't take a shot at the Red Blacks, and that's kind of what I'm going to do here. I wrote about it for Three Down. I think their move to deny their offensive coordinator, Jamie Elizondo, a chance to interview for the Riders head coaching position was selfish and short-sighted. I don't like the move. I don't like the move, but the Bombers made where they are not allowing Paul LaPolice to do so either. I just think that if a guy has a chance for a promotion to end, especially if a guy has a chance to become a head coach, which those jobs are so scarce, I think you do right by that guy and you let him interview. Do you agree with me on this, Mike, or do you disagree?
I don't necessarily disagree. I'm just going to give a little bit of the other perspective of when do teams have to look out for themselves sometimes, don't they? I mean, losing Elizondo and Paul LaPolice would probably be a huge blow to the Red Blacks and the Blue Bombers. Do I think they should be allowed to interview and advance their coaching career? Of course, but also you just got to look at the team's perspective as well.
I understand that. My problem with all this is basically there's a rule in place that says teams have to ask permission to speak to coaches, and this rule is only there because the Red Blacks were a bunch of whiny babies when Edmonton wanted to hire Jason Moss. When Chris Jones left Edmonton to go to Saskatchewan, Edmonton wanted to hire Jason Moss, and the Red Black put up a stink. It's like, we have him under contract, and he shouldn't be yada, yada, yada. But yet, for decades, the league had operated on, if you're a quarterback's coach and you're interviewing for an offensive coordinator role, you get to do that because it's a promotion. If you're an OC or a DC and you're interviewing for a head coaching job, you get to do that because it's a promotion. And instead of just codifying that rule. They make this one where, well, now teams have to seek permission and compensation has to be talked about and all this other sorts of stuff because these guys in Ottawa didn't want to play by the rules that everyone else was playing by and they pitched a fit. And now we have this kind of needless extra layer of BS. Like, I'm sure you saw the tweet from Farhan Logi. Paul LaPolice is pissed off that he can't go interview with the Riders. Mike O'Shea apparently went into Wade Miller's office and said, I back him, let him go interview. He apparently, LaPolice has language in his contract that says if a head coaching job becomes available, he is allowed to interview for it, and they're denying him this. I just feel like it's short-sighted in the sense that you're now going to have an employee who's probably pretty ticked off working for you. And what happens now when his contract comes up in a year and you want to bring him back and he just says, you know what? I'm not interested in working for people that don't have my best interests at heart. We've seen it time and time again with teams letting their coordinators, letting their positional coaches go and interview for bigger roles. I just don't see why we should have anything other than a rule that states, I guess the problem I guess I have, it's less with the Red Blacks, it's less with the Bombers, and it's more with this stupid rule. I just don't understand why we have to have a rule in place that needs to have all this red tape when it should just be as simple as if a coach is offered an opportunity to interview for promotion, he's allowed to do it, period, end of sentence. Why we need more than that, I don't understand.
That's fair enough. I'm not going to argue with you on those points.
Oh, well, that's rare. I was expecting an argument. Okay, so let's move on to the only other thing I want to talk about the Chris Jones thing. Who's going to be the head coach for the Saskatchewan Roughriders in 2019? We know it's not going to be Jamie Elizondo. We know it's not going to be Paul LaPolice, and we know it's not going to be Chris Jones. So, Mike, who do you think the head coach will be for the Riders this year?
It doesn't necessarily leave a ton of options left over, does it?
Not really.
That you would know about, familiar name in the CFL. But funny enough that you were just – well, maybe – I don't know if you're serious or not, but you mentioned on Twitter Jerry Glanville. And then out of nowhere – the next day, it seems that has become a legit option. Were you serious about that tweet? Do you think it would be a good idea for the Riders?
I don't know if it'd be a good idea. I think it'd be a fun idea.
Yeah.
But yes, I am glad you brought that up because on January 15th, I have it on. I'm looking at the on my phone at 7:32 p.m. I tweeted out, "Just replace one man in black with another. The next head coach of the Saskatchewan Roughriders. Don't act like you don't want it." And it's a picture of Jerry Glanville. And then let's find Dave Naylor's tweet on January 16th, which just so happens to be my birthday, at 1:50 p.m., so about 12 or so, a little more than 12 hours later. "As the Saskatchewan Roughriders prepare for a head coaching search, here is a name I'm led to believe is interested, Jerry Glanville." I had it first. Now, I was mostly joking, to be perfectly honest. I just thought, you know, Chris Jones wore black. Jerry Glanville's known for wearing black. He's a defensive guy. And I had heard, and I recall hearing during the last regular season, that Glanville had so much fun coaching in the CFL that he thought he could be a head coach somewhere. So there's an opening here. I thought it would just be a funny thing to post. And lo and behold, it's actually apparently legitimate. I think Naylor even had a tweet yesterday saying that Glanville is interested in the job. And like this, there's some steam to this. So I wouldn't be surprised if he's the head coach. I think that's the fun option. That's the one I'd go with because Jerry Glanville at a coach's press conference out in Saskatchewan of all places, that would be an absolute hoot.
It would be tremendous. June Jones and Glanville gave us a lot of interesting clips last season. So it's always good to have characters in the league, as head coach.
And, they'll get to do battle twice this year when the Riders and Tigers play, so that'd be fun too.
Yep, Jones' offense against Glanville's defense. The battle that will never end.
There's a couple other names I think are tied to this. Craig Dickinson, the special teams coordinator in Saskatchewan, I think that's a possibility. Mike Benavides, who was fired as the defensive coordinator in Edmonton.
I wouldn't do that.
He's got head coaching experience, and he's got defensive coordinator experience. And this stupid, idiotic coaching cap, this football ops cap, might make it a little bit tough. Maybe the Riders are looking for a guy that can do both. Jerry Glanville could be both the defensive coordinator and the head coach as well. The one name that I kind of want to kibosh because I keep hearing people bring it up is Mark Trestman. I don't see it. I honestly don't see Trestman going to Saskatchewan to be the head coach, but that's just me. If I'm a betting man, I feel like it's Craig Dickinson. If I want to put money on something fun and maybe make a few bucks, I'd pick Glanville.
Yeah, Dickinson has been a special teams coordinator for a number of years in the CFL. He never really stepped up to be a DC or an OC. It'd be an interesting jump from special teams coordinator to head coach. I think the last person to do that was O'Shea, and it's turned out pretty well. So it's going to be interesting because that Saskatchewan job attaches a lot of pressure to it. So whoever it is going to have to be ready to have a lot of attention on them.
So this happened, oh, geez, it feels like a decade ago now, but it was probably only about a month and maybe 6 weeks ago. The other coaching vacancies that we had this offseason in BC and Toronto were filled in the interim of us doing our last show and us sitting down and doing this one. The Lions hired Devon Claybrooks. The Argos hired Corey Chamberlain. Both those guys were considered the front runners for both those jobs, and both teams made those choices. Out of those two hires, Mike, which one do you like more?
I like the Claybrooks hiring more. Chamberlain, obviously, he's a Grey Cup winning head coach. He did a tremendous job in 2017 with the Argonauts defense. But I just think that Claybrooks teamed up with Ed Hervey. You got a top end GM who's going to pull in a lot of talent. And then you got a head or a coach like Claybrooks, who has had the best defense by far in the league over the last, three or four seasons with Calgary. So I think his transition from defensive coordinator to head coach is going to be a smooth one. And I think he'll have a lot of success in BC.
I agree with you on Claybrooks for all the reasons that you mentioned. I also just don't really like Corey Chamberlain as a head coach. I know he won a Grey Cup in Saskatchewan. I get that he's, maybe a little bit revered there, although maybe not so much because of how everything ended. I'm just not sold on him as a head coach, to be perfectly honest with you, just because of how that tenure there ended. And the Riders in 2013 went all in. Like, they overspent. They were fined for going over the cap. They brought in veteran players. They paid big money to guys like Leroy Simon, and they paid big money to guys like John Chick to bring them back in. They loaded that team up to win the Grey Cup at home. I think a tin can could have won that Grey Cup for them. I'm not saying Chamberlain's a bad coach. I'm just not super sold on him as a head coach. So for that reason alone, I'd side with Claybrooks. And then, of course, everything you said, I like that as well. How do you think Claybrooks' exit from Calgary is going to affect them? Because they lose him. Looks like they're going to lose Bo Levi Mitchell. They've lost who? Jameer Thurman, Alex Singleton, Mark and Michelle. Like, the laundry list of players, like top-end players the Stamps have lost, on top of now losing their stud defensive coordinator. How do you think this will affect the Stamps?
Well, I've always been of the thought that, until they start losing, I'm not going to, lose trust in that organization, because Calgary seems to just find ways to plug those holes every year. But losing your quarterback, losing your defensive coordinator, two of the best in the league at what they do, and you mentioned some of the players that have left to the NFL. I think finally we're going to see a little bit of a downward turn in the Calgary Stampeders this upcoming season. I think those losses are a little bit too much for them to sustain and be at the top of the West next year. So I don't think that they're going to be a terrible team. I think that Huffnagel, is a hell of a GM, and he'll bring in talent, and Dickinson is a good coach, and they'll find people to fill in those holes. But you gotta think that's, at some point this franchise is going to fall off, and I think it might be this year.
Well, that's a lot of guys to lose, especially you lose your quarterback, you lose your defensive coordinator, and you lose your best defensive player all in one offseason. That's a lot for any team to overcome. And I don't think everyone's, I can't speak for everyone, but I can speak for myself. I don't want the Calgary run to come to an end because I hate the Stampeders. But I just look at this team, and they're a team in transition. They're a team in flux, as are most teams in the West, maybe outside of, like, Winnipeg. Every other team out there is, like, you don't know what's going on. Like, Mike Riley, where he lands is going to decide the fortunes of one of those two teams out there, because I think it's really only Edmonton and BC that he's looking towards. And then you have, well, we just talked about the Riders. Who knows what's going on with them? And then you have the Stamps losing all this top-end talent is on the coaching side and on the field. That's a lot of upheaval for any team to deal with. And yes, Calgary can plug and play, But have they ever? They haven't really ever since Henry Burris went there. They've never really had to plug and play the quarterback. Like they went from Burris to Kevin Glenn to, well, I guess Drew Tate was in there a little bit too, to Mitchell, and it was always guys who were in house for a long time. Is Nick Arbuckle the guy for the Stampeders going forward? I don't know. Like, I don't know if the Stamps will fall off, and I'm kind of with you until I see them start like 2-4. I won't sit here and go the Stamps are done, but this team is going to have a lot of question marks heading into this season coming up. So I think it'll make things more interesting because now you can't just plug Calgary in as guaranteed to be the top seed and winning 14, 15 games and hosting the West Final. So I think it makes for a more interesting league when the dominant team kind of takes a hit, but I don't know. I'm not sure. I think you put everything in the mix with Clay Brooks's exit and all the players, and I think it's going to have a major effect on the Stampeders.
Yeah, I think it's time for a little bit of a rearrangement in the Western Conference. I think BC is a little bit off topic, but I think BC is on the rise. I think they might be a dominant team for the next couple of years, but we'll see.
If they get Mike Riley,
yes, absolutely.
I think they're my pick to win the West.
Yeah, gotta agree.
Because him and that offense, oh jeez, that would be
scary.
With those playmakers, with Brian Burnham, and they bring back Manny Arsenault. Anyway, that is a little off topic. Let's continue talking about the coaches. Last question for you, Mike. Of the three new head coaches coming into 2018, Clay Brooks, Chamberlain, and of course the guy here in Hamilton, Orlando Steinhauer, which one do you think will be the most successful in 2019, and which one do you think will be the most successful over the long haul?
2019, I'm going to go with our own guy, Orlando Steinhauer. I just think the pieces are in place. You know, depending on who they sign in free agency, but you got June Jones coming back, who ran an incredibly successful offense. You know, I think that players will want to come back to play for him in that offense. So, you know, if they get the right free agents back, I think this team will be pretty successful next year. Overhaul, I'm going to have to go with Clay Brooks. I think that, you know, if Ed Hervey's in there for the long term, he's going to bring in tremendous talent. He did a great job at Edmonton. He's a great GM. So, you know, for the long haul, I'm going to have to go with Clay Brooks.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I don't think the Argos are in the East, so it's like you can go from worst to first in this division very easily. With all the upheaval in the West, I still think, again, a lot depends on what happens at the quarterback position with BC. If they get Mike Riley, they shoot to the top of the list, as far as I'm concerned, as Grey Cup favorites. And I mean to win the whole damn thing, not just win the West, not just to get there, but to win it all. Because with Mike Riley, like I just said, Mike Riley and the guys they have on that offense, that's a dangerous, dangerous thing. Steinhauer, though, he overtakes a team that's fairly set. Of these three, he's the one that has his guaranteed starter for next year. Like, maybe James Franklin is a starting quarterback for the Argos. Maybe not. Who knows? Steinhauer knows who his quarterback is going to be. Steinhauer has the pieces in place, especially Canadians. Ted Laurent is going to be back. Luke Tasker is going to be back. Jalen Saunders, we know, is going to be back. I feel there's less turmoil with who will and won't be in Hamilton as there is in Toronto and BC. And yes, there's still a laundry list of players the Tigers have to sign, big name players, guys like Larry Dean, guys like Brandon Banks. I just feel like for this season, it wouldn't shock me if the Ticats won the Grey Cup this year, if they were able to bring back a majority of their pending free agents and pretty much rolled out the same team that they had last year for the most part with just the change of head coach. But over the long haul, and especially if BC gets Mike Riley or they nailed whoever their quarterback going forward is going to be, I think the Lions could be set up to be a Calgary-like dynasty for the next 5 years.
I was shocked that Jonathan Jennings got a tryout in the NFL.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I was floored by that. I mean, the guy can't.
I mean, but we never talked about this. The kicker for the Ticats got a tryout with the Seattle Seahawks. Like, that was shocking to me. Did they watch him kick last year?
Apparently not, because we talked about him almost every single podcast that we did. But I suppose he was okay kicking field goals. His punting was pretty bad. You know, his kickoffs were pretty bad, so maybe they're just looking at him as a field goal kicker. But even then, you know, he wasn't great field goal kicking either. I mean, beyond the long ones, yes, but the ones that he should have made, he missed quite a bit. So I was pretty surprised to see that news too.
So I was playing that Maximum Football game I fired up the PlayStation on Christmas time. I was like, oh, you know what? I haven't played this in a while. Let's try it again. There were some updates to it. Whatever. It's the same essential game. I play as the Ticats, and I did a kickoff. And I say Ticats, but whatever the Hamilton team name is. And I kicked it out of bounds. I was like, man, this game's pretty accurate.
Yeah. They got the player traits down to a T.
Okay. So last thing we're going to talk about this week, Mike, this is something you want to talk about. CFL held a combine and a draft for Mexican players. Was it last week? I think it was last Monday, I believe, was the draft. Mm-hmm. And the combine was on the weekend before. You told me in a text message that you wanted to talk about this, that you have something to get off your chest about it. So, Mike, the floor is yours. Have at it, my friend.
It's just so much snarky comments by the media and by fans alike. I just don't see what the big problem is with it. I don't think it's going to affect the CBA negotiations. I don't believe they're going to start talking until February, no matter what. So for them to be doing something else, I don't think it affects that. I think it's a long-term plan. They are hoping to get their tentacles in Mexico. You know, they're a growing football country. You know, I think it could be good. You know, the talent might not be there right now for the draft, and you're not going to bring in. Each player is not going to come in and, you know, dominate the CFL. But I think that as those countries progress in their football, maybe there's an opportunity there. If you could, you know, I looked at all the leagues, semi-pro or minor leagues in places like Central and South America. There's 15 leagues of American football in Central and South America, 34 leagues in Europe, 21 leagues in Asia, and 11 leagues in Australia and New Zealand. So this is the American football, Canadian football is a growing sport. And I think that for them to be ahead of the curve and trying, I know that the NFL has been places like London and Mexico, but for them to be going to places like Europe and talking with those leagues, I think is a good thing. And I don't think there can be anything bad that comes from this. You know, there's been a lot of talk of, oh, why aren't they talking about the CBA? I covered that. I don't think they're talking no matter what until February. I don't know why. I'd like for them to talk earlier, but this is what they're doing. This is what they did last time. I think that the teams individually are responsible for creating a buzz, like teams like Toronto, Montreal, BC. The CFL head office, I don't think they can really do anything to create excitement around those franchises. I think the franchises themselves have to do, have to create the buzz around the club to draw in fans. So overall, I think there's been a lot of snark and a lot of negative things said about this, but I don't see anything bad coming from it. What do you say?
So about the why aren't they doing the CBA? Why aren't they doing this and that? That to me is not an argument, because you can do multiple things at once. And just because one thing's not getting done doesn't mean you don't try to do something on another venture. So, like, I think that anyone making that comment either doesn't understand how things work or just is being negative for the sake of being negative, which, I know who you're talking about when you talk about some of these things. So, yeah, some of them are negative for being sake of negative. All that said, I just don't get why and why now and why this. Like, I get wanting to grow the game. I get maybe looking for an inroad into Mexico. But here's the thing. I think the commissioner talked about this. He said they're essentially looking for, like, the Yao Ming of Mexican football to be sort of that superstar or that name guy that comes to Canada to play football that ends up exploding the game south of the border. But if they find that guy, isn't he just going to leave for the NFL after his first car? If he's that good, where he becomes sort of like a cultural icon, that it's like, oh, all of Mexico's cheering for this guy because he's dominating the CFL. Once his contract's up, he's gone. He's going to the NFL because that is the league. Whether CFL fans want to hear that or admit that or not, the NFL is where the best players go to play. And if the CFL unearths some super talented Mexican player, he's only up here for a rookie deal and then he's gone. That's as much as I hate to say it, that's just kind of just the fact of the matter. I just don't understand or see the point of this from an on the field perspective, because I'm sure you saw the same things I saw in the lead up to this. I think it was, again, Dave Naylor, who was talking about the scouts down there, the GMs down there, said there are maybe six guys who wouldn't look out of place at a camp, maybe another six who could be developed into being that good, and then a bunch of garbage. And that might be hard to hear, but if that's the truth, that's the truth. Six guys that are maybe eligible, able to compete at a camp, that's not telling you these guys are going to make the roster. That's six guys that might be able to come to camp and not, you know, vomit all over themselves and trip over their own shoelaces. Like, that's not a particularly high bar as far as I'm concerned. And I know getting into a pro football camp is not easy by any stretch of the imagination, but you put all this money and time and resources into this to get six guys who might be okay to be at a training camp. There's nine teams in this league, Mike. And we're not even getting into, well, how are they going to classify these guys? Personally, I think, last I checked, the league has two designations. They have nationals for guys who count as Canadians and internationals for essentially everybody else. Is Mexico not international? Why do we need a potential third rail here for Mexican players when at the same time we've never given that to Canadian quarterbacks? I'm sure you remember the arguments of why don't teams have a developmental roster spot for Canadian quarterbacks? And everyone will always say, well, there's not nine good Canadian quarterbacks. Apparently, there's not nine good Mexican football players that were in this combining draft. So you're going to set aside potentially a roster spot for these players because you want to grow the game, or you want to, you know, con the Mexicans out of some money by giving them a TV contract for guys that are never going to see the field. Like, remember when Johnny Manziel was coming into the league and everyone was talking about Johnny Manziel and Johnny Manziel, and it was all over the TV, and every time the Ticats of the Outlaws played a game, they would lead with Johnny Manziel's on the sidelines. If the league's edict is we're trying to build a television contract to get into Mexico, you don't think that the one Mexican player on one team or two or however many it is going to be the focal point of coverage that's going to drive people up the wall? Like, you, if you thought the Johnny Manziel stuff was bad, imagine when the league's not only focused on trying to get fans in the U.S. to give a crap about the CFL, but now they're trying to get into Mexico as well. So now we got to take these Mexican players and we got to make them into stars and we got to make them into household names and all those sorts of stuff. And they're talking about a guy who's third string playing special teams only, and they're talking about him like he's a second coming of Jesus. Like, I don't think this is necessarily a bad idea. I think from a business perspective, I get it. But at the same time, I'm just not sure if now is the right time. And clearly, they haven't got all their ducks in a row because they're arguing over what their designation will be. Like, it just seems like this was kind of rushed. I think that's kind of the whole where I'm kind of coming at the end of this. It's like, it just felt like it was all of a sudden, and it was like, we're just going to do this, and we'll figure out everything else later. And that just doesn't seem like a good way to go about business.
That's a fair point, but I just look at, and you say about the players, I agree, like, you know, there's not that many top-end players, if any, that'll come out of this draft, but I think it's a long-term thing that maybe 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road, there's more talent because more kids are more interested in the NFL or the CFL. You look at, you know, cable TV is not what it used to be. You know, the thing that cable providers or cable channels really want is live sporting events. So if you could get a contract in Mexico, a couple countries in Europe, maybe Asia, you know, you add some money to the league, some revenue that wasn't there before. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it is a possibility with the cable channels, you know, wanting live content, and this is live content. So even if it's $1 million that they give, you know, one country gives $1 million, another country gives $1 million, that's another thing, you know, another route of revenue that the league could take advantage of. You know, the TV contract in Canada is good for what it is, but it's not going up anytime soon. I believe they're signed with TSN till like 2021. That's a source of revenue that's not going to raise. So, you know, maybe getting these TV contracts in foreign countries will help out the league in the future.
From a business perspective, sure. I get that. But you mentioned, like, they go down there, and it's a long-term commitment, and maybe in 10 years we'll find some guys or whatever. Why are they doing that in Canada? Like, it's the Canadian Football League. And I get
– Right. And did I've they heard not all, just Didn't the league donate $4 million to Canada grassroots football this year? Or not donate, but raised?
Yeah, $4 million. Okay, cool. For grassroots football. But, like, why are we not – look, if it's a long-term investment in the betterment of the game – because to me, you know what matters most about CFL is the on-field product. Honestly, if the on-field product is good, people will flock to it. Like, that's just –
I wouldn't say flock. It doesn't really matter what it is. People are not going to flock to the CFL.
But they have we ever given it a shot? Like, have we ever tried? It's always worrying about trying to find the next thing. Let's get this. Let's get that. But the on-field product is what matters the most. If the on-field product sucks.
The on-field product was like the best it's been in the 90s, and they were basically running out of business. They were going to go out of business.
But that's,
you know,
bad.
I mean, like,
but
I remember back
business.
In the 90s.
But that was bad business. That was blackouts, and that was not every game was televised. Every game is televised. And I just look at it, if you're putting subpar players on the field, if we're saying, oh, there's going to be a designated Mexican player and then he's got to play, that dilutes the play on the field. And that's what I'm getting at here. It's if the play on the field, it doesn't matter how much money you raise from a Mexican audience or a German audience or a Polish audience. If you're putting a subpar product in the field, people are going to not want to watch. If it's bad football, no one's going to care. And if you force these guys on the field, or you force teams to have these guys in the roster when they're not ready, how does that help the league in the long run?
I don't think that they're going to be forcing anyone to, like, I don't think if there's a Mexican player on a roster, I don't think coaches are going to push him to the forefront and he'll be a starter. Like, if he's not good enough, he's not good enough. And I don't know, you know, what they're going to do with the international Canadian rule, adding a new – I don't know all about that. I would agree with you that if they're going to force, you know, a different standard for – you know, there's international players for Americans and there's a new standard for these Mexican, Europe guys or whatever, German guys, then I don't agree with that. You know, if they're not good enough, they're not good enough. But I don't – see any harm in, you know, trying to get players interested that are from foreign countries.
But then what's the harm in having a Canadian developmental quarterback spot? Like, all these years we've poo-pooed that idea because there's not enough good players. But if there's not enough good players internationally, it's the same thing. You're forcing,
yeah.
Because here's the thing, if I don't know if this was going to happen, but let's say you force teams to carry one non-American, non-Canadian player. If they got to be on the roster, they got to play something. You don't have – aside from the backup and third-string quarterbacks, every other player on the roster sees the field at some point in the game. So if you got a player who might not be good enough to play, who could be taking a position, like, are they going to add a – like, there's too much uncertainty around this right now to really get into the nuts and bolts of it. But this is kind of my problem with the CFL as a whole, is they do these things and then don't tell you anything about it or haven't figured it out yet. Like, it's how have we had a combine and a draft and we don't know how these guys are going to be you? Like, I don't know. It's just – it seems backwards to me to not
– Maybe the whole draft thing was kind of a front. Like, they know that they're not going to use these players. They just want to get into these countries and, you know. Soak some money out of them. I'm not sure.
Maybe, but they had a draft of what, like 27 players, but apparently only six of them can. Like, I don't know. I just wish that maybe they would have taken a deep breath, figured out an infrastructure for this thing and how it would all work, and then go about doing it. Because, like, to me, there's just so many things we don't know yet that it makes it hard to rationally dislike it or rationally like it without. Sound like we're basically just shooting off theories here right now. And I know, right. We do that a lot on this show where we just give our opinions, but I at least like to think that we give our opinions based on the things we know, because we know, oh, well, this works because of this and that. There's just nothing here. It's like, it's all literally the definition of
it's
throwing
crap
at the wall and letting it say it's all potential, but it's like, I just wish we had some information so we could intelligently debate this subject, because I just don't know
enough,
how this
yeah.
is all going to work out. It felt rushed to me. And I think that's where I come on the why did we do it now train, because it just felt like it happened and like we don't know what's next. And not knowing what's next is kind of frustrating, because you can't intelligently talk about something if you don't know how everything's going to play out.
Right. I'd love to know more details. I'm with you there. Maybe this, could have been planned out. Maybe they could have done it next year when they had more of their ducks lined up. You know what I mean? But to me, the overall idea isn't a bad thing. Maybe just the way they went about it was a little rushed. I'll agree with you there.
Yeah, and I just worry that they make such a big deal out of this in January, and what if come June, none of these guys or anything, and then we just go, why did we waste all this time in January talking about it?
Yeah, I can see that.
I mean, we on this show last year decided we weren't going to talk about you-know-who. We weren't going to talk about Johnny Manziel. We made a pact together. We will not bring up his name until he signs a contract because it was just too much of Johnny, 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 Johnny. And maybe that cost us listeners. Maybe that we could have had a higher listener count if we would have just been Johnny Manziel all the time, but we decided because we were sick of talking about him not to talk about Johnny Manziel. We knew more about Johnny Manziel than we know about this Mexican stuff.
True. And I heard that he's going to Germany next week, and I think Germany might be a burgeoning talent pool.
German players in the NFL. One guy was drafted in the last couple of years too. So yeah, like, look, football is becoming an international game, and I love that. That's great. But let's figure out how this is all going to work out before we start, slobbering all of ourselves. The CFL is going to be playing games in Italy, and like the idea that they were going to play a game in Mexico this year. Like, come on, man. Actually, we never talked about that. The schedule came out. They're doing another Touchdown Atlantic. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, they don't know where they're playing yet. But
they don't know. They don't know where they're playing. But
when was the one? One of the options was Sackville or something. I don't think that's a very big town. But
why wouldn't they just move to New Brunswick?
Moncton or Halifax, I think, would be the smarter idea.
Yeah, who is it? The Owls and the Argos. Like, it's a perfect game because those, not like either of those teams sell very well. So stick it out east and let people travel. I traveled to the one the Ticats played in. It was a hell of a time.
Yeah, I think that the Argos have, obviously, we talked about this at length, have a tough time selling tickets. So for them to give up a home game isn't that big of a deal. And I think that with Johnny Manziel, as you just mentioned, being the presumed quarterback of the Montreal Alouettes, that'll give some football boners to people out there in the East Coast who are obsessed with anything NFL. So there you go.
Yeah, I remember when I went to that game in 2011, there was a lot of New England Patriots jerseys.
Oh.
A lot of NFL jerseys in the crowd.
Overwhelming New England Patriots. Yeah. They think they're from Boston in the East Coast, but I don't want to get
the East Coast seems
I don't
so
want
nice.
To I don't want to get Boston's everyone mad at me out there.
it's a shame too, cuz like I liked it out there, and Boston's just full of assholes, so
mm-hmm.
Oh well, yeah. It sucks. That was Podski Weaver for this week. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.
Eat 'em raw.
Thanks for listening. Find more great shows like this at CF Pod Network on Twitter.